Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. My co-host on the Egg Chasers Rugby podcast, Cocker, is at Cocker. And, of course, the podcast we do. You can find this one at the Rugby Dungeon. You can find Egg Chasers at Rugby Podcast. And, as always, the Rugby Dungeon is brought to you by Beardmore & Co, independent financial advisors. You can find exactly what we do on our website, Beardmore IFA. Yeah, that's all of the housekeeping done. Now you can sit back and enjoy this. It is a chat with Benjamin Kayser. How are you?
I am good, thanks. Just moved to England and back in August. The welcome has not been the warmest because of lockdown and obviously COVID putting everything at a stop. But life is good.
You live in England?
I do, yeah. Whereabouts? I live in Tunbridge Wells, in Kent.
Oh, very nice. Well, how come that has come about?
So basically, I played for Leicester Tigers between 2007 and 2009. Mm-hmm. And I met my wife there, who was from Kent originally, who was studying in Leicester. And then she came back to France with me for 11 years. We have two little girls that are 6 and 3, and it was always in the back of our heads to basically come back at some point. To make sure that the girls are fully bilingual and can go to an international school and all that. And the fact also is that with Eurostar, it is so convenient to be within reach of Paris.
Yeah.
It's actually closer to be based in London than to be based anywhere else in France. And on top of that, I am back studying. I'm doing an MBA at Oxford.
Yeah.
So basically the idea of being not too far from Oxford for the networking, school for the girls, and within the reach of London and Paris is a good spot for us to be based for the next, I don't know how many years, where I'm figuring out what the next step is post-rugby.
Wow. Well, they do say, don't they, that London is something like the third biggest French city in terms of...
Exactly.
In terms of French nationals.
Exactly. I think there's about 350,000 French people in London. The whole population of Clermont-Ferrand, where I stayed for 10 years, is 160,000.
Wow.
That tells you.
So I guess we should start with the serious stuff. You're not really a fan of the rugby jerseys I've got up behind me.
No, I'm just very proud. Listen, 10 years of swallowing my pride, of admitting defeat, of trying to explain the unexplainable, of underperformance of French rugby. And now finally, for the last 6 months, we've been shining a little bit. We're a little bit back from the dead and back to where we should be. The journey is not over. There's still a lot of work to be done. Okay, but I'm finally can express basically my love for France and my pride of being French. So that's why when I see the British and Irish Lions jersey behind you, which is obviously a fantastic jersey, and I can't wait to see you in action next summer. I would love to see a little Frenchy one there because at the moment they're hot.
You know, I've got about three or four French jerseys, and the reason they're not up, or the reason that two of them aren't up, is because I regularly wear them. So, there you go. Just on the Lions, I was going to ask you something else. No, in fact, I'll ask you something else first. I'll ask you my last trivial question, and then we'll get on some actual serious rugby. I always wanted to ask you. Your yellow gloves that you wear on TV, are those official Clermont gloves or have you got them from somewhere else?
I'll tell you what, forget about rugby. Those yellow gloves are about the right balance in life. And when my wife gives me a Christmas gift, which are a hot pair of yellow gloves that I love. And she tells me, oh, they would look really nice, you know, with your coat. Then I do what I'm told. And so whatever the stick that I got afterwards, I saw some funny ones. So, yeah, great chat and stuff. But yeah, I look like I have Mickey Mouse hands, you know, with those massive sort of white gloves and all that. Somebody was asking me if I needed to go do the dishes or whatever it was. It's great fun. I love those gloves. They've got nothing to do with Clermont.
Oh, they're not. The
my wife has got great taste. And let's face it, I'm a little bit whipped.
There we go then. Yeah, just on France on the Lions. Do you know, I think the ultimate Lions tour, of course it can never happen because of the way things are structured, but the Lions should go to France. I think that would be, outside of maybe Argentina, no, actually, including Argentina, that would be the best tour.
That would be the best tour, but I mean, considering the Lions now, I think they're playing Japan, aren't they? A couple of weeks before the tour or stuff like that. That would be extraordinary. Just to start out with a friendly game at least. But definitely, when you think about, I think what people like about the Lions tour is also discovering a new country. Mm. It's going there for a couple of weeks. Those midweek games, everybody's loves them because, you know, they're just special. They actually represent, you go through the full spectrum of what New Zealand, South Africa and Australia rugby is all about, which is what we all love. And where I agree with you is it would be extraordinary to get the Lions to then play midweek in Biarritz and then go to Perpignan and then you go to Toulouse and then you go to game in Paris and then you finally build up to the big games. It would be extraordinary, but we're too close. So well, I don't think it will ever happen. And if anything, they should invite a guest of honor, one Frenchman, you know, in to play for the Lions.
Exactly. Well, it's an interesting one that because you say we're too close, but quite regularly in an international calendar, England will see one of the home nations, well, no, actually, that's wrong. They will see one of the home nations once a year. So England play France once a year. In that same year, they might well play Australia three or four times. And if you think about how close the two countries are, French rugby in the UK is still surrounded in mystery. I mean, the most we can say about it is, oh, it depends which French team shows up, or there's a few cliches that band around, but no one really understands it over here.
Well, that's precisely the reason why myself and Johnny Beatty decided to do a podcast from last summer, and we were doing at the moment with Tim Groves, the French Rugby Pod. It's exactly that. Listen, I am one of the few French speakers, who is comfortable to speak in English. Mm-hmm. So those questions have been asked my whole career. How come France are underperforming? What's going on with France? Explain to me the difference. Why would French people do that? Why do this with that? So it's exactly what we're trying to address in that podcast and just answering all those questions. It is fascinating. I think it's a lot more than rugby. It's about psychology. It's about our history and how history of a country and a sport and organization can actually shape the way that you behave and the way that you react to things. And it's just, it's diversity, I think, is always good. So the more you know about others, you know, the more the wealthier you are, at least in your soul and your brain. So I know, and to be honest, one of the reasons also that we created this podcast is because I heard a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Some English guys that would play in France, come back and just go with the absolute cliches of the French are lazy, the French are underperformers, the French will do this, do that. No, we're different, okay? But it doesn't mean that the English are better or the French are better. It just means that we're different. We do things in different ways. There's a lot of things that have to be improved in French rugby, okay? But it's just a different animal. So learn to love us. Don't judge.
So what are the most common misconceptions that you hear then about French rugby?
That the French are unfit. Mm. Unfit, unprofessional, don't train hard enough. That could have been true maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it is true. Like I arrived in Leicester Tigers in 2007 from Stade Français, who were a fantastic club at the time. And we just won the top 14, actually, in June 2007 against Clermont. And getting to Leicester was a whole different step. I thought I got drafted in the NFL. Like it was a different setup. In terms of professionalism, and I mean, that was the whole charisma about Stade Français. That's why our soul and the culture was so strong. It wasn't in the infrastructure. It was in the fact that you would take a little scooter Vespa to go into this rented conditioning place gym that we would use that definitely wasn't ours, that was shared by loads of people, and then you would drive to another place. So that sort of humble how do you say that, like system day, whatever, make things work, whatever, you know, just like be almost street smart, whatever, and make it work. Let's stay humble and all that. Let's be different and still perform. That was the whole ethos around Stade Français. And when I got to Leicester, there was a conditioner for three or four players. We had the whole access to extra nutrition. They would cook breakfast for us. Getting my kit cleaned, you know, that was something I've never had.
Really?
You get to Leicester, there was, in Stade Français, mate, they give you a bag in the beginning of the day and they will go. But not a lot of French clubs clean that. That's a very new thing.
No.
They don't. Yeah, honest. So when I got to Clermont, when I arrived in Clermont in 2011, also I was very comfortable with that because they would clean your kit and put it in the place. And so otherwise, you don't have a washing machine at home? You just take your stuff, you go home, you clean your stuff and you come back with it. You know, that's just how I was brought up. And so basically to tell you, yes, at the time, I think there was a difference in professionalism and level of training and stuff. But I always give those examples. You explain... a group of 10 English lads, guys, you guys need to run around this track 10 times, whatever. Mm-hmm. They'll run, they'll finish, they'll do well, and then they'll be like, oh, why did we do this? Okay. You do the same thing to 10 French people, and they will moan, they will complain, they will want to know. But if you explain them why it will be beneficial, how to do it, and you challenge them to do well, not only will they run around the pitch, but they will run around or 10 times around the track as fast as they can. And most definitely a lot faster than anybody else. But it takes time and you need to convince them and they need to believe in it, which are the barriers that are crazy. That's why we're capable of the most incredible highs, but also of the most disappointing lows.
Really interesting. So one of the things which is often said about the French is... They are particularly hard to coach, and also maybe the Anglo way of doing things doesn't work too well. But I guess if you're an Anglo coach and you just say you must do this in that very dictatorial manner, you're not going to get the results. It's about the understanding.
Precisely. I think you've got it spot on. Look at Sean Edwards. Sean Edwards, don't tell me he's the most diplomat coach in the world. He's a bit of a tyrant. But I think he nailed it because he moved to France.
Yeah.
He doesn't speak really well French, but he's trying. He moved his whole family to France. Apparently, from what I've heard, he really bought into the whole culture of not trying to tell people how it's done, but bring the best out of his methods. Like, this is what I can bring to you. Now let's make something French out of it. Not saying, I used to do this in England and we'll do precisely the same thing there. So he actually adapted, and the success is huge, and all the players and Fabien Galthié, everybody recognized how good he is. So basically, where you're dead right is that we are open. I think French players are very easy to coach. They are, but great coaches will have a variety of different management or leadership techniques they can implement instead of just being a dictator.
Yeah,
you win the trust, you actually show who you are as a human being, and then you will do it. We need that human connection. We need not only just the sort of the strategic and technical talent to say, right, this guy's a fantastic coach. I actually need to believe in you, but I need to believe in your soul, you know? Show me that you're ready to go that extra mile with you. But if you get both connected, that's when magic happens.
Yeah, you've said that word a few times now, soul. How important is that to... the way a French team operates? Because in my mind, I don't really care if my coach has got soul or not, just so long as he tells me what to do or how to train, or as long as he's adding value, I don't really care what the man thinks deep down.
But that's your way of seeing things. It's not mine. I think, to be totally honest, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just different way of seeing it. I thoroughly believe that professional sport, high-level competition, team sport, forget about professional, just competition team sport, especially rugby, deserves and needs the extra bit of passion, camaraderie, brotherhood, soul, purpose, whatever it is that you want to call us.
Yeah.
I think that we perform better, we will remember it better, and it's all about the... I mean, I started rugby when I was pretty old. I started when I was 14, a little bit out of nowhere, because my dad was a consultant, so we traveled a lot. That's why I speak English.
Okay.
We traveled a lot abroad. We went to China, I lived in the States and all that. What really made me click with rugby was the brotherhood, was the mates, was the friends.
Yeah.
Was being part of something where I also thought that the skinniest dude, the tiniest, who would not hurt a soul, could still be the bravest guy on the pitch, just because even if he doesn't put a big tackle, if the smallest dude throws himself on the knees of the biggest opposition fella, that's a true sign of absolute courage, if you know what I mean.
No, I completely agree with that.
Whereas at school, it would be the biggest dude with the biggest mouth, but that would never really do much, you know? So it's a different hierarchy, a different way of assessing courage and merit. And so I do believe that I need purpose, I need passion, I need the soul, I need the drive from the heart to actually perform, not only because that's why I fell in love with rugby, but it's also because I really do think that's what makes us perform even better.
Yeah.
And a career is titles, mates, and memories. And I think to get all of them together, you need that extra bit of passion and soul. But that's just the way that I see it.
Excellent. So looking back at the French team, not this French team we have now, we'll come to them later, but the recent incarnations who just haven't quite clicked, why do you think that is? Is that a technical problem with the way the French are selecting their teams and the boring, dull administrative part of the game? Or is that something a bit more fundamental?
That's a big, big question.
It is.
That we answer quite a lot in the French rugby pod, because that is the question that I get asked all the time, and it's a big topic. I believe that it's funny because it's the I'm back studying at Oxford. I'm doing an MBA, mm-hmm. and I had to do my application process, and in it there was like one of the questions, you know, is like a case study, and they're like, give us a problem or organization and three ways to solve it. And I took as the problem the underperformance or whatever, the disaster of French rugby.
Oh, amazing.
Like. So I actually have a whole case study on it, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
I probably took some time to think about it, to assess, because it's something very dear to my heart. And I think there's a lot more in the answer than just, they need to pick a better coach. They're lacking five world-class players. That's it. It's a lot deeper.
Can I?
And the
Can I read that after we're done?
yeah, I'm sure you can.
Sorry,
so basically the answer for me is a structural problem,
mm-hmm.
which consequences are the fact that nobody drives in the same direction. So the structural problem is French rugby is not school-based like in England.
Yes.
It's club-based. So which means that the Stade Français, the Toulouse, the Birds and all that, you can start when you're 6 years old. So you have to understand that the power of French rugby is within the clubs, and that will never change because we are very much proud of it as well. We can adapt, modern rugby can adapt, but a province sort of federation led like in the, like for the Celts, like for the Welsh and the Irish, that will never work. That is just not France. So I think England is quite similar to some extent, but that is how we have to be structured. And the federation was always extremely poorly run because it was a federation that was there to generate enough cash to basically have fun for French rugby. But it was never run like a business.
Mm.
It was free meals and free cars and this and that for the mate of your mate of your mate to stay happy. So the politics were dreadful. There was never even an election. There was never a challenge at the election. They called it an election, but there was only one candidate. You know, so that's not really a stressful moment, is it?
Yeah.
And then professional rugby arrived, and so the federation delegated the rights to the league to organize and promote and commercialize professional rugby, which is first and second division, and now a little bit of third division, national one. And the league did such a good job at creating an extraordinary product, not extraordinary product, but an exciting product and a great economy with the great Max Guazzini of Stade Français, who then ended up putting six times 80,000 people for league games and European games at Stade de France, you know, something that's just unheard of. And they promoted all that. Then some extra presidents came into this world, but they're not Max Guazzini. They are tough buggers who will not take no for an answer and who are very driven and very ambitious. And so basically the league took an extraordinary power that it was never meant to have, but because they generated all the cash, the Federation doesn't have the cash to actually implement anything. I mean, I was comparing sort of turnover balance sheets of the RFU and the FFR. The RFU, I think they make 180 million a year.
Yeah.
They make 90 million of profit.
Do they really? Is it that much?
Yeah, but the 90 million of profit is already given into, they don't keep any of that as pure profit. It's already, they need to support X amount of different projects. So the money is never kept, it's already given, but still, and that's all down to Twickenham because they own Twickenham. And I think they make 40 million just thanks to hospitality per year.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ginormous. France need to sell a minimum of, or used to, because now there's a new deal, used to be able to sell 50,000 tickets at Stade de France to start making €1.
Wow.
Because they rent the club. They rent the stadium to the consortium of Stade de France, which owns the stadium. The FFR do not own it. And then they get, obviously, to cut the cost on the rents. It's only from the 50,000 seats. So you understand that they need the money from the league. They need that economy. So that's why they delegated all that power and they left it. But now we get to a point where the clubs are so strong that they dictate everything with the broadcaster and everything. And the Federation would just pick up the pieces.
Yes.
Now they are clearly clashing. Clearly clashing. So to answer your question, the reason why France rugby underperformed for the last 10 years is a slow top 14, which is based on economy, not on quality of play. Mm-hmm. And not made to create a fantastic French team. It's made to create an exciting, money-rewarding premiership, but it's not made to create players to go play for the French team and then to perform on an international level.
I see.
It's the fact that there is absolutely zero common goal at achieving something. So if you're an international player, you will know if you're picked or not picked on Twitter because the coaches and the guys never really speak. You will basically then, you don't know exactly who is your employee because you're fully contracted with the clubs. But when you leave for international windows, you feel that you're letting your club down. But then when you want to go back to your club, you feel you're not a good patriot because you're not fighting for your country enough.
Yeah.
So you constantly have your seat in between two chairs, you know, and you don't know where you're going. And the Federation does not have the power dominance because they don't have the money to actually implement everything that they want. So this whole underperformance is too many games. Top 14 is not made to do that, but is not meant to create international players. But the main answer is saying not everybody's shooting the same way. The league is going one way, the Federation is going the other, and the players are caught in the middle.
That's really interesting. So I think about how the home unions over here are structured, but we'll just focus on England for a second. The way I look at it is England are at the top of the tree and all the clubs serve into England. That is where the money is. That's where the glamour is. It's not clear to me that France is the same way. I mean, you look at the clubs that you played at, Stade Francais, in its pomp, Clermont is just some organisation. So you can see there's obviously a bit more parity there between what you do for a day job and then when you get picked for your national team. And I wonder if having the national team, and this sounds like heresy, but having the national team almost as a product of the league or having it under league control is better than having the league under Federation control or RFU control as we have it over here.
The problem is who's the boss?
Yeah.
Who decides? And as long as it's the Minister of Sport creates the Federation delegates the rights to the league, then the Federation has to be the boss.
Oh,
the Minister
right?
of Sport has to be the boss.
Yeah. I had no idea that it had any kind of government input.
Of course. Well, yeah, the federations are created by governments and stuff, and they're under the jurisdiction of the Minister of Sport and all that, you know?
Oh.
And which is one of the reasons why of the renewal of French rugby is also majorly down to the fact that the World Cup is in 2023 is in France.
Yeah.
So I think now it's becoming to the fact that it's, I think the Minister of Sport really knocked on their door. The fact that Bernard Laporte, the new French president, clearly wants to become the boss of French rugby and doesn't want any in between decision makers and all that. But that's why I was very, very optimistic in February to think, finally, everybody's like, listen, let's cut the crap. In 3 years' time, every single rugby eye in the world is going to be looking at France. Whether we perform or not, we need to be the best host nations ever. I want to be the next Japan. Like, people came back from Japan and would be like, what a country. What an organization. Rugby just was extraordinary there. Whether you win or you lose, that's the type of image that I wanted to give. Mm. But if the league is on one side, the federation is on the other, nobody's actually playing sort of part of the team, it's not going to work. So in February, I was super, super excited about finally seeing people going together. Galtier, it finally we're building basically a coaching staff, which is good. We get Sean Edwards. We get the best defense coach in the world. We're finally proving to say that we need to improve. We need to change things. We're going to change. Fabien Galtier got 42 players for his training camps during the Six Nations, which he's been asking for a long time. Before, it used to be 30. So he could do full oppositions on Wednesday. And the coaching staff of the French Federation has never been so present in the clubs. They are constantly there, constantly exchanging and constantly going. When they picked the French team, the first initial French team in February, there was a few guys who got picked who honestly were a bit big surprises. And a few of them were coming from Bordeaux. And Raphaël Ibanez and Fabien Galtier bluntly said, the guy who knows the best the Bordeaux players is the Bordeaux coach, Christophe Furios. We picked them because he told us, at the moment they're on fire, you will never be disappointed. And I think that's precisely what French team needs. They need that input and that general, listen, the coaches feel that they can almost, at a distance or with a certain level, they can almost push somebody to get selected rather than having those coaches, the French team coaches above all the clubs to be like, I know better than everybody else.
Yeah.
I will decide and I will do that. Because I can tell you from a fact, when the French team was losing, most French coaches would be saying, ah, I do a better job than him. Bah, that's a shame. And then it's the first time there was Ibanez, Galtier, Laurent Labitte. They're piling quality instead of being... When's the last time that you had... Who's the defense coach of England? John Mitchell. John Mitchell coached the All Blacks. Mm. Head coach of the All Blacks. That's like the biggest possible job you can get in world rugby coaching. Yeah. Right? He's still... Of course, there's a lot of money for RFU, so he's not doing this for free. But he still has the humility to say, yes, I will be under Eddie Jones. Farrell was under Joe Schmidt for a long, long time. That never caused him any problem. For the last history of French rugby, whenever it was Guy Noves, the other guys were like, no, no, no. Either I come number one or I don't come. There was never a time where we said, listen, we're going to pick the best forward coach, the best bass coach, the best head coach, the best conditioner. No, it was one guy coming with his coaching staff that were clearly under him that he had control on. But yeah. We never piled up competence, you know, knowledge, skill, whatever it was. It was more one guy.
I've got to say, yeah, there have been some strange appointments. I mean, Guy Noves actually wasn't one of the strange ones because he had such a rich history and, you know, won so much with
too late.
It was too late. But, you know, you can sort of make that argument, I guess. Who was the other guy who he had coached France before, very recently? He was a forwards coach, I think, Bordeaux?
A forwards coach for Bordeaux?
Was he forwards coach for Bordeaux or Lyon? The French coach before Galtier?
Before who?
Before Galtier.
Before Galtier was Jacques Brunel.
Yes. He was a forward. I mean, I know he'd coached before that, but didn't they?
Yeah, but he was... Do you know what happened? Is that Jacques Brunel was the forwards coach of Bernard Laporte for 8 years.
Ah.
And Bernard Laporte was French president. And Bernard Laporte put Jacques Brunel in there because Bernard Laporte was technically almost the coach of the French team.
Got you.
So that's, again, it's exactly what I'm telling you. It's not... You're not piling any quality... You're just making sure that you're the boss. You're just making sure that everybody will listen to you.
I'm with you.
So it is extremely frustrating to see that all those little... The fact that nobody works together, nobody goes in the same direction, caused the dramas and especially the underperformance of French rugby for the last 10 years.
But do you think some of the headbutting and some of the not getting on so well is a product of having such a competitive league? Yeah, because
I don't think so. Do you think Super Rugby is not competitive? Do you think the Premiership is not competitive?
I don't think it's competitive in the way that the top 14 is. I think top 14 is probably the most competitive league in the world. It's certainly got the most money in.
Exactly. It's certainly got the biggest personalities. But you're putting your finger on it. What's competition? What's the performing? I think top 14 is self-proclaimed best Premiership in the world. But what does best Premiership mean? Best quality rugby played? Heck no.
Is it
the most economical, the biggest economical power? Well, then yes, definitely.
Do you not think the two things are interlinked though? Do you not think that?
I don't think so, no. I thoroughly do not think so. And I think that's the problem.
So I would say that the money in the top 14 is just a different way to express its success. And the reason it's got the money is because it can attract all of these big presidents, because they look at it and think, this is where I want to put my cash. If it was about the standard of rugby, all these wealthy individuals, and there's plenty of them in Australia and South Africa, they would be piling their money into Super Rugby. But for whatever reason it is, there's something about the French game which inspires people to part with their cash. And that in itself is a real powerful thing.
It is, but that's not down to the new top 14, is down to the roots of French rugby. Like I said, if you go play in Bayonne, in Toulouse, in Perpignan, or in Paris, you feel that you've traveled the world. It's four different places. The rugby is completely different. That's the originality and the reason why people fall in love with France so much. We've got an incredible country, to be honest. Mm. And the fans are just absolutely berserk about their rugby, and that makes it super exciting. People, the passion for rugby in France is ginormous.
But I guess
that's what makes it super exciting and super good. So basically, the top 14, what it's created is they thought exactly what you said. They thought that rewarding by money was a proof of success.
Yeah.
Generating money was a proof of success. I don't believe it. And they're realizing now, because they realized if the French team then starts collapsing, it's bad for rugby in general, and it does impact the top 14.
Yeah.
If the quality of play is not that extraordinary because either the players are not there or the economical stress is so high that the refs it's poorly refed because the refs just can't take the decision without having sort of, a laser at the back of their heads. The coaches cannot really take the risk of launching young players because the risk is too big.
Yeah.
The economical risk is too big and the pressure is too high. So that pressure, now they're realizing, is counterproductive. And I really do think they're realizing that we sort of shot ourselves in the foot a little bit.
What you said then is really interesting, particularly about, the different styles of play and how you can go to different parts of France and you experience a different game. Because I guess that all feeds into it. Because if you think, I don't know what the styles of play are, but say if Clermont have a style and the Clermont coach gets the gig, presumably the people who were brought up on Biarritz rugby will think, well, that is completely wrong, or the Parisian rugby crowd, or whoever it is. So I guess that's what I mean by the competition. I mean, it's all grown up in such different ways.
True, and that is also true with the French team. Every time we implement a new coaching staff, obviously you want the coaching staff and the head of French rugby to implement his own style. Okay. But we had a loss of identity. Mm. So we talk about the French flair. Forget about the French flair. That's history. But even just playing attacking rugby was not what we did under Philippe Saint-André.
Yes.
And then Guinoves came and then he started doing something else. And I don't know if you remember Marc Lièvremont when he first started, he created this thing. International rugby said, you're not allowed to kick in the ball. But he went too far in French rugby, in French flair, sorry. Then Philippe Saint-André went too far the other way around. And then Guinoves was sort of stuck in the middle. Then Jacques Brunel, we don't know what he did. And now Galtier is finally trying to say, listen.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's exactly what you said. We need to have throughout France and throughout French rugby in general the common knowledge and the common idea that that's the type of rugby that we want to play. I hate to jealous them, but you got to admit that the Kiwis, they know something or two about rugby.
They do.
They are pretty good, you have to say. And the one thing that I'm jealous of them is they know their identity of rugby. So generations will change and things need to change and this, but they know the type of rugby they want to play.
Yeah.
And they know where they want to go. And I think France has struggled with that. We did not know which type of rugby we wanted to play for a long, long time.
But I think that's the beauty of it. So you're absolutely right. And anyone who says that the Kiwis don't know what they're talking about themselves does not know what they're talking about. But they don't inspire me. They don't inspire me like the French do. Because the whole point of the French, for me at least, is they do turn over New Zealand. And they do it at historic times, and you know, just because they're bad one week, they'll be great the next. And I think actually I prefer the diversity of styles rather than just knowing one thing and, you know, being really, really good at that one thing. I mean, I just don't get excited by New Zealand rugby, which I know is a very strange thing to say for a guy who loves watching rugby.
I think you're just jealous because they win a lot.
Oh no, but they are wonderful.
I am as well. No, I see what you mean. But because that's the nature of competition. You also like the underdog. You want the surprise. You want the little guy beating the big guy. It's true. We all want that. This is part of rugby. You know, an odd shaped ball that bounces sometimes your way, sometimes doesn't. That's what we all love about rugby. We all want the mess of rugby that it generates, and that's why I'm always fuming when I still see that people want to make the scrum cleaner and this cleaner. Rugby can't be clean,
and it
shouldn't be clean. The cleaner it gets, the more boring it gets, the more predictable it gets. We need the big fellas to tire, otherwise you will not have any more gaps. And if you want to transform this. I mean, imagine how hard it is to find space now.
Yes.
Imagine how hard it will be if you can actually change and not have any more of those heavy guys that can't shift their weight as better as before. If you have 15 back rows on the field, it's going to be one boring game.
It really is. I'm glad you said that. This is going off topic a bit, but we are going into a scenario now because of COVID and no one can help with that. It's the best we can hope for. But the scrum at grassroots level is going to be outlawed, effectively. Well, no, not effectively. Yeah, it is outlawed. So over the next 6 months, we're going to find out exactly what rugby union will look like without a scrum. And I think you're right. It'll just be more back rows. And hey, if you look at the law changes now where there's one dynamic movement and then, you know, you get a penalty against you if you roll, well, then I've got a feeling we're going to just see a lot more kicking. So you're absolutely right on that.
But unfortunately, you can't stay at 15 on the pitch. So let's face it. If people want to play rugby league, let's play rugby league.
Yeah.
I've seen some crap rugby league games. I've seen some fantastic rugby league games as well.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was never a fan of rugby league until I watched sort of Australian NRL, I think they call it or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes it does get very, very exciting.
Oh, it's great. It is great.
I'm not a big NFL fan at all.
Mm.
But then I actually saw some plays where they can pass the ball to each other. I didn't know they were allowed to do that. And it's a whole different sport.
Yeah.
You know, so it's also the way that you do it. But I agree with you. If getting rid of the scrum, you're going to kill the identity of rugby union. And so there's no point even trying. And going to all those cleaner, more predictable phases by implementing new rules is going to kill our spirits. I mean, what do you like in the crowd? You like the big guy who can bump off the little one, but who can't chase the fast one. You know, we need the tall, we need the small, we need the crazy, we need the brain guy. And that's the reason why I desperately need others. And that's why it's a great school of life. And that's the reason why, going back to the fact that why I fell in love with it, in the nature of this sport, you need others. in the nature of this sport, you are fuck all with somebody who's not different than you next to you. And that's what is the biggest lesson in life, basically. That's why it teaches us so much, is that we are absolutely nothing without others. And so people are like, oh, the values is great. You guys show a lot of solidarity. So, yeah, okay. But it's a necessity. Mm. We can't go with it. And I think the more cleaner you make it, like you say, if we can have 15 back rows on the pitch and stuff, then am I going to need as much of my mates? Not really.
Exactly.
So you're killing the soul of this game if you do that.
Yeah. Now, just to revisit something you said before, could you just give me some examples of where in France I get different styles of rugby? Because I found that comment really interesting.
So obviously it's down to coaching and stuff, but Toulouse will always have historically a very open, offloading, leave the ball alive type of play. They always said it comes from make sure that you how do you say it? Make sure that you implement the continuity of the game.
Yes.
So from when they start rugby at six, they are told the ball needs to stay alive, keep it alive, offload, put it down, clean the ball as quick as you can, keep on putting pace to the ball. That's what they do. So their kicking game has never been extraordinary, but in their soul, in their DNA, they are raised by just keeping the ball alive. And mm-hmm. It's true that you do see it a lot. I mean, they've got something about them that's how they're wired, that they just keep it alive and keep on going. Don't get me wrong, they still have a massive scrum. And when they had the Yannick Jozion, the Florian Fritz to play centers, at two centers that were over 110 kgs, yeah. You know, so they're still very, very physical. But they in their minds, it was keep the ball alive. You go to Perpignan and Toulon as well, it's all about aggressivity. Mm. You need to be angry on the edge. So they can be very violent, very, very, very to the limit, impossible to lose at home, you know, that type of mentality, yeah. You know, that. Burritz, sort of southwest, a little bit in between, but then all the east, the Lyon, the Grenoble, the Bourgoin, the Clermont, the Brive, are very much more forwards orientated, hard grafters, not as flash, you know, but the grafters, the Leicesters, the Northamptons, and all that. And then Paris will just discover their own style, you know, because they're a little bit out there. But it's more about the panache. I mean, Paris, look at the racing, the Eden Park story of 1991, the reason why they won it wearing a pink bow tie, and that the physio had a Scottish kilt and brought them their orange juice on the glass flutes, you know. That was them. They painted their faces in black one day because there were some racist insults from one of the black players that played for them. They were just doing all sorts of crazy stuff because nobody knew them in Paris. Nobody cares about rugby in Paris. And they need to create something different. And then Stade Français, 20 years later, did exactly the same thing.
Yes.
The pink jerseys, the calendars, wearing blazers, playing the pom-pom girls. The shows before the game, because you need to create something that's not there. So it's just a little bit the same recipes every time.
Now, you are a Parisian yourself, yes?
I am, yeah, born and raised.
Where do you see the soul of the French game, or is it not quite that simple?
It's not that. Originally, I thought it was Southwest.
Yeah.
Originally, for me, the French game is Southwest-based. If I don't get it wrong, historically, like 100 years ago, that's actually where it comes from. Mm-hmm. It comes from this game called La Soule, which is quite a crazy game if you look it up on the internet. It's basically villages. That's what the history of rugby. Villages where you had an odd-shaped ball.
Yeah.
And they would hide it, I think. And the whole idea was like the whole village need to bring the ball on the other way, on the other village. So you could do it whatever you want. It was more of a brawl than rugby, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But it was a way of just getting this piece of ball somewhere else. So... And then the first actual club, so they played a lot of league after that. And then the first actual club, I think, is in Paris. It was either Stade Français or Racing. That's why Stade Français are like 17 times champion in history, but they're like 10 times champion from 1910 to 1940 or something. Whereas there was three clubs, there was Bordeaux, Racing, and them, and they kept on playing between each other, you know. So I thought the soul was Toulouse. But to be honest, living 10 years in Clermont, I've never seen such passion and such fanatism as in Clermont. They are absolutely crazy about their rugby, a lot more than I thought.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It is amazing.
They are completely banana. But I mean, kids, grandmothers, women, whatever it is, everyone. So I think it's pretty much spread around everywhere, but originally it's based in Southwest.
Just on the Clermont thing, I've been lucky enough to watch a Clermont versus Stade Francais game in Paris. I've travelled over to see it. Not that anyone doesn't know this already, but yeah, you're absolutely right. The Clermont fans are wild. So what I wanted to ask is, how much difference is there from playing, the reception you get from your Clermont fans compared to the reception you get when you finally get picked for the French team? Do you feel the same sort of appreciation from the French public in general for the French team as you would from the Clermont fans?
Oh, no, you can't even compare. You can't compare. It doesn't mean that the welcoming of the French fans is big, but it's different. It's French fans. Look, we just said the difference of rugby in France all over, yeah. And the French fans come from all over. So they're already, there's not one thing, there's not such a thing as one French fan. They always have a club under their French jersey. There's always a club there,
yeah.
You know, and sort of a region and something. Clermont, honestly, is mind-blowing. Like, I've got goosebumps every time I think about the greatest moments that they make me feel. The semi-final against Saracens in Saint-Étienne in 2015. Saint-Étienne is 110 Ks, so it's like 90 miles away from Clermont.
Yeah.
We're very, very much in the mind, sort of very similar towns. You know, people, you know, when two towns sort of connect emotionally and stuff. Mm. So it was huge for the club to go play in the Geoffroy Guichard, which is the football stadium at Saint-Étienne. Fantastic stadium.
Yeah.
The whole region of Clermont drove to Saint-Étienne for the game. The whole motorway. So it's 90 miles. It took them 6 hours to drive. The whole motorway was with the 63 license plates, which is the license plate of Clermont,
yeah.
Everywhere. We got to the stadium. It's the first time in my life I almost wanted to tell them to calm down because I couldn't hear a thing to what my teammates were saying. It was so incredibly loud, and the support was outstanding that we did one lap to say thank you. Then we just kept on going a second one, and then we kept on going. I think we did 3 or 4 or 5. Yeah. We just loved that moment, and nobody left their seat. And then we drove back. It is... unreal to see the devotion and the passion that these people can see. I always take the example that in 2017, so we lose the Champions Cup final to Saracens, unfortunately, and then we end up winning the top 14, which was awesome.
Mm.
And then in Clermont, there's a big Place de Jaude, like the center of town, there's like a big rectangle. There was 100,000 people on that sort of city center,
yeah,
place. Out of 160,000 people in the town.
That's something, isn't it?
Never seen so many people, everybody clapping. It was just a surreal experience. And a couple of weeks after, I went to David Shuttle's wedding in England, mm-hmm. and I bumped into Brad Barrett, his former Saracens captain.
Yeah.
And we were chatting away, and he was like, oh, I saw the celebrations. That's awesome. Congratulations. I'm really, really jealous. I was like, well, your third Champions Cup title, surely you did something. He's like, yeah, I've been living 10 years in St. Albans or something. And there's my local club pub at the bottom of my house that he always goes like to for a pint on the Sunday and this and that. And I had a bit of a session with a few of his teammates on the Sunday. And he sees like a plateau of beers arriving. And he's like, oh, finally, 10 years living in that pub, I'm finally going to get a free pint for my third Champions Cup title, you know? And they have a few beers, they're having a laugh. And at the end of the day, the ticket arrives and he asks them to pay the bill. So he didn't get a free pint. He didn't even get a free pint for his third Champions Cup title. I had 100,000 people clapping me, or clapping us, obviously, in our city center. And it was just mind-blowing. So you can't even start to compare the Clermont fans with anything else. They are respectful, crazy, committed. When we went to Saracens, remember that game that got cancelled because of the snow?
Yes.
Well, not cancelled, but postponed a couple of days.
And then you battered them on the Monday.
Then we battered them. There's people who came. So it's a good, Clermont is not a rich town. They're humble people who work hard. And when they spend $50 on a ticket, it's important to them. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So when they travel to London, it's, listen, we're not going to go on a holiday this year because we went to follow the team in London. That's pretty much what it means to them.
It's incredible.
And The game was on a Saturday, I think, and we ended up playing the Monday or the Sunday night. I can't remember. Mm. Except there wasn't any planes to come back. So the people were meant to fly back the Saturday after the game.
Yeah.
I know that there's fans that went back to their hotel. The hotel was full that night. They had to sleep in a conference room on the floor, on the carpets. The next day, they came to the stadium. They watched the game with us. They couldn't fly back. We had a private plane. We flew back to Clermont. We were back that Sunday. Mm. They came back the Tuesday because the Sunday flight couldn't go. The Monday flight couldn't go. You know, that's paid off. That's, how do you say it? Leave days off work. You know what I mean? Unpaid days off work that you need to take off work and stuff to do that. They did not say anything to us. They were just so happy to be there. I'm like, I'm looking at these people. I'm thinking the commitment that they're showing is just mind-blowing. For just a simple Champions Cup game, they traveled 4 days. They spent the money for the holidays for that year. And they didn't even complain. They slept on the floor and they didn't even complain about it. And they were super happy to say, oh, we have not missed it for the world. Like, you know, that's just,
it's amazing,
that's just taking
it
to a whole different level.
But I think people just like that sense of belonging to something a little bit bigger than themselves.
Oh yeah, wow, Clermont, it's 100% that. It's everyone.
Yeah,
but not even in so we had, that's a good times. We had some bad times, obviously, and never aggressive, never mean.
Was it difficult for you? Because I was looking up your career before we had a chat. So you're Parisian, born and bred. You were obviously at Stade before you went to Tigers. You went to Tigers, back to Stade, but then you left Stade again. So I'm just reading between the lines there. It sounds like you had to make some difficult decisions.
No, so what happened is that 2007, I'm 23, or 22, things are going great. It's Stade Français and I'm almost in the French team and all that, but I'm in competition with Dimitri Zarzewski.
Yep.
And we were in competition our whole life. I mean, he started for the under-21s. I was on the bench. Then he went in the French team. I started for the under-21s. Then I did France A. And then he signed in my club in Stade Français. We're constantly in competition.
Yes.
And I'm about to re-sign for Stade Français just because I love Paris too much and all that. I didn't see myself playing anywhere else in France at the time. And Juan Hernandez was in contact with Leicester Tigers. And Gustin Pichot was a good mate of mine, and we're literally in the bus, and he's like, oh, so what are you doing next year? I'm about to resign. He's like, are you sure? I was like, well, I think so. I don't really fancy going anywhere else. Yes, the competition is a bit shit, but you know, I'll just go back myself. He's like, what about Leicester? Oh, I don't know. I never thought about even going anywhere else. He's like, let me try. So he just sent a message. He's like, I see the message that he's writing. Would you be interested in Ben Kayser? And you know how you see the text under when it says typing? You know, three little dot, dot, dot. I'm literally, we're waiting on this, and it's the director of rugby or somebody from Leicester was like, yes, please, very interesting. That's how it happened.
Wow.
And on Monday, I had a phone call from Richard Cockrell, who knew all about my career, who knew anything about me and whatever. And then we left it because we ended up playing Leicester in the quarterfinal of Champions Cup. I don't know if you remember that game where Alisana Tuilagi gets whacked by Juan Hernandez
in the
meter from the line. That one. And I started that game and I had a really good game because Dimitri was injured. Mm. And I had a really good game. And Welford Road is just a beautiful stadium when it's full.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
The sun was out. They tricked me.
Yeah.
And it was just an extraordinary day. And we just lost. But at that time, Leicester were ginormous. They were beating everyone. That year, they did three finals, won two titles.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I was like, bloody hell. So I said, that's me drafting to the NFL. And the week after that quarterfinal, they were like, listen, come over, come for a visit. And they made me a good offer and I went to visit the facilities. It just blew my mind. I was like, yeah, that's the challenge for me. And it was nothing for me to go because my English was already good. So whether I was going to Clermont, to Bird, to wherever, it was easy. Mm-hmm. And then after that, moving from Leicester, where I wanted to go back to France because of I was just in the French team and they needed more visibility. The French coach was like, everybody was leaving. You know, Chabal was going back. Saint-André was leaving. Lionel Faure, Sébastien Bruno, all those guys from Sale were going back to France. So I would have been the only Frenchman in the Premiership. So he completely out of the eye, you know, off the radar.
Yeah,
so I went back to France. And Clermont made me an offer. And I was like, I was with my wife at the time. I was like, I'm the French one. I'm telling you, we will never live in Clermont. It's too small. It's too remote. It's not us, nothing. And then I was about to sign somewhere else or re-sign in Leicester maybe. And then I had this whole thing with Dimitri who said, oh, you can't come. We were in French team together at the time. So you can't come back to Stade, you know, otherwise it's going to be war. I said, what do you mean it's going to be war? I started in the academy of Stade Français. Nobody's going to tell me whether I can play or not in Leicester. You know, my parents live in Paris. My grandfather lives in Paris. My uncle is there. So, and my grandfather wasn't well at the time, so I wanted to come back. So I took it as a challenge, went back to Stade. Incredibly poor decision. Shit here. And then after a few months, I had to find a solution just because Stade was struggling financially. I wasn't happy. I wasn't playing well. And so I signed 1 year in Castres, but I'd already signed for Clermont for the 4 years after that.
Yeah. Yes.
So that's why it went like that. But it all happens that you need to be open-minded. I told my wife, we will never play in Clermont. And actually, one day I went to visit for once.
Yeah.
Like an idiot. I've never been to Clermont ever. And actually, I was like, oh, this is a lot better than I thought.
Yeah.
A lot better than the shit hotel that I remember and the bus drive that we always used to do, you know, because you don't really see much when you go to a town. You see a coffee shop, a hotel, and an airport or a train station. That's about it. And that was the best decision I've made.
Incredible stuff. Incredible. Yeah, I do think of you, you know, as one of the last French players. I know there have been lads subsequently. I think Julien Dupré was probably...
He was there same time as me.
Yeah. Obviously, we've had Picamoles. But when we've had the French players over, they've added so much to the game. It's just a shame that we don't have more. I'm based up in Manchester, so I remember Chabal and Bruno and all those boys really, really well.
Yeah.
But who's
it? No, I would really... pushed. Like, I was disappointed when, you know, the really stocky New Caledonia, French, but hooker Christopher Tolofua.
Yeah.
I thought that was a terrific, terrific signing.
Is that where he's from? New Caledonia?
Yeah.
Was the big second row from New Caledonia as well? The
Romain Tao, yeah.
Yeah. No, who am I thinking of? The other guy.
Bamaina.
Yes, him. He's new.
Yeah, they all are. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was disappointing, actually. I'm with you there. I thought he was going to be superb for Saracens with that natural size and the natural gift that he has in the Saracens team. I thought he was going to be an absolute world beater.
Yeah, same. But you English, is the way to see it, which I learned in Leicester. To be fair, how many hookers play hooker in England that can't throw? None. They play six.
Yeah.
How many tens play 10 if they can't kick? None. They play 12.
Yes, true.
But in France, François Trinduc had 40 caps for France and he started learning to kick at 26 or 27.
No.
Rémi Thalès started kicking when he was 30. And Christopher Tolofua is a beast in the scrum, can do anything on the pitch but can't throw for his life and still got picked for the French team when he was 19.
Bloody hell.
We're like, oh, we'll pick it up. He'll get there. That's another difference between France and England for you.
That's incredible. Particularly the bit about Rémi Thalès, because I love the way that guy plays. I've always wondered why he didn't have more caps.
Well, it was mainly due to that. He couldn't kick.
He
doesn't kick the post. No, he doesn't. Then he started when he was 31 because Philippe Saint-André told him, listen, you have to, otherwise I can't start you because you couldn't have two options. And because at the time he was also playing with some nines that didn't kick. But it's funny because in France, a lot of the nines kick.
Yeah,
Machin,
yeah.
Para, Bézi, even Dupont now is starting a little bit. Serin, you know, whereas in England, it's all the tens that kick. It's just different.
So how do you see this French team now then? Do you see them as a bit... In fact, actually, let me just dovetail that into the current fly half. Entermac, because he isn't a 10. He's actually a 12. So is he the other way around, a 12 that can kick, so they moved him over to 10?
No, he's played 10 a lot when he was young.
Yeah.
But I think when he got to professional rugby, they had to put him at 12. I honestly think it's almost to protect him, to relieve him from a little bit of the... In France, the 12s play like 12s. They don't really play like, I don't know how you call that, second fives, or you know what I mean? Like another 10?
Yeah.
We don't really have many 12s like Owen Farrell in France and all that. We very rarely play with George Ford or Owen Farrell. You know, have your big stocky guy will play 12 and the faster guy will play 13.
So that's why you get your Jonathan Dantes or whoever it may be.
Yeah. Bastaro, you know, all those guys. Usually, it's not always the case, but usually you get one big stocky guy and another guy. Even at the moment, Gael Ficou, Vakatawa, incredible players, but none of them are real organisers of play, are they?
No, they're not actually. I've never really thought of it that way.
So that's a very English thing. It's a very English thing to do that second five, I think they call it, whatever, which in certain cases can be incredibly productive. But in the same time, if you can have both Gael Ficou, Vakatawa, Teddy Thomas, Damien Penaud, whatever, you've got some threats everywhere.
Yeah.
So it depends how you want to play.
I guess the guy who would buck that trend for French 12s would have been Damien Trai back in the day, because he could play 10 and he was an enormous 12 too.
And he was very, very good, I have to say. I rated him highly. Had a great kicking game and could do everything. It always makes me laugh when people are like, the physiques in rugby are just, off the charts now. In the good old days, this, good old days, that. Damien Trai was a monster. Yannick Jozion was a monster. Aurélien Rougerie is a freak of nature.
Yeah.
David Skrela was still 1.92 meters for 100 kgs and played 10.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Vincent Clerc was no little guy. We still have some massive, massive players, even at the time. Well, and even, don't get me started with the Olivier Roumat and the Olivier Merle and the Gérard Chollet and all those guys. They are ginormous human beings. Yeah. They've always been there. And everybody's like, the rugby players are just getting bigger and faster and bigger and bigger. Not really. There's always been monsters all the time. It's just the game. There's too many games. That's the problem.
The funny thing about that backline that you named them, because they did all play together, didn't they? Skrela and Jozion and Trai. You don't even think of Skrela as a big man because the other guys were so big.
Yeah. Well, Jozion, Rougerie, Trai for backs.
Yeah.
They were tall, they were fast, and they were strong, very, very strong. Even Florian Fritz is still like your very, very solid center next to him that wouldn't look as big as them, or Vincent Clerc. They're still 100 kgs and they could hit.
Yeah, yeah. Jozion was probably one of my favourite players of all time. I think he's just outrageously talented. So how do you see this current crop going? Obviously, there's been a huge turnover and they are the talk of the town now. Why are they different?
They're different because, again, in February, for the first time, people started working together. Mm-hmm. They're different because because about 6 or 7 years ago, there was a terrific amount of work done by the Federation to put a lot of money and time and structure in the under-20s setup. They basically copied the English model.
Yeah.
Because at the time, England were killing the under-20s at level. They were repeatedly being world champions, and France just didn't understand why. So they really put a lot of time and money into it, and we're blessed with a generation of not only good players, but world-class players.
Yeah.
Especially 9 and 10 is making such a huge difference. Because you do have Dupont and Tamac, okay, everybody's heard and we spoke about them enough and they're doing extremely well. But behind, you still have Serin, you still have Bézi, you still have Jalibert, you still have Carbonel. Yes. When's the last time you had three 10s for France that were under 22 or under 23? And the three of them, I'm telling you, are gifted. Mm. They're very, very good. So that's tremendous. Finally, like I said, the reason is an extraordinary young generation. Finally, all the political power trying to work together. So the bridge and the walls between the federation and the club is starting to open up and the communication is better and they're actually working together. And also, finally, we had a coaching staff that is piling knowledge and competence and skill rather than just friendship and tight bonds. I mean, Jacques Brunel was there because Bernard Laporte put him there. Now you go pick Galtier. The former manager of the French team did not even speak English. Now it's Raphaël Ibanez, who's like worldwide, very good politician, very good diplomat, and he can represent and knows what international rugby is. The forwards coach of the French team used to be, who was it? Well, the lineouts coach was Julien Bonner, my former mate from Clermont. Never coached in his life.
Yeah,
and they gave him the French team gig. But I wouldn't say no. But they still picked him. Now they went to get Karim Ghezal, the guy from Lyon, who's for the last 5 years doing a fantastic job. They took forwards coach. They took William Servat, almost one of the best forwards coaches, or probably the best forwards there is. They needed a backs coach. It used to be Jean-Baptiste Elissalde, who coached the under-18s, then got sacked by Toulouse. And they went to get Laurent Labitte, who's one of the best coaches around there. The former conditioner used to be Nicolas Jean-Jean, 20 caps for France. Okay, but he was CrossFit instructor 6 months before. Now they went to get Thibaut Giroud, who is one of the best conditioners. You know what I mean? So it's a complete change of quality in the coaching, in the back office or whatever you want to call it, in the coaching staff. That is and Sean Edwards, obviously, I forgot to say, they went to get the best defense coach in the world.
Yeah.
So those changes are just so new, hot generation, finally people working together, and the quality of the coaching staff.
It's really interesting that. Bonaire came straight from Lyon, did he not?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they had a serious outfit and a serious lineout too. They had
oh, absolutely! But he wasn't the lineup coach.
No, he was still playing.
He was an incredible, legendary player. I was blessed to play 5 years with him. Gifted in the lineup, loved it. But he didn't coach the lineup at Lyon. It was Karim Ghezal and that Julien Puricelli.
I was going to say Puricelli, the captain.
That's what he does. That's what Puricelli does. He retired and he's the lineup coach. And then I grew there.
Yeah, I watched one of their games a few years ago now. And Puricelli just absolutely ran the show. And not necessarily on their ball, but on defensive ball. He was superb.
Yeah.
Absolutely superb.
One of the best line-out defence in France.
Excellent. Well, you've been more than generous with your time, Benjamin. Thank you so much. Tell us about your podcast, when it comes out, what days it comes out, where we can download it, where you are on social media, all of that good stuff. Oh, hang on. No, not yet.
Yeah.
One last thing. Yeah. You're doing your MBA.
Yeah.
At Oxford. Now, I've encountered a lot of ex-rugby players who do degrees and whatnot at Oxford post-playing. But part of that is they show up for the Oxford team. Are you going to be playing again?
No. I would have loved to be honest. I think the experience would have been amazing. So I help out whenever I'm there coaching-wise.
Yeah.
So I've been for the last two modules. So I did about 4 or 5 trainings with them and stuff, and I love it. And it's a very exciting Oxford team for next year. I think the varsity match has been pushed to March.
Mm-hmm.
It was meant to be in December. It was meant to be sort of next week, but it's been pushed to March. There's a very exciting teams with some USA internationals. I can't really tell you all the names, but there's some very, very solid players there. And I just love, I love it. I love the how important everything is when you represent Oxford over there.
Yeah.
I love that rivalry. I love that history. I love that proud of the thing. And I'm really good mates with Flip van der Merwe, the Springbok former lock, who's in Cambridge with James Horwell.
Yeah.
And they both played the last varsity match. And he said, yes, the traveling was a bit tough and you go to some cheap hotels and this and that. But they loved the experience of the actual match day varsity. They said it was well worth it. It goes back to the roots of why we like rugby,
game.
We fell in love with it and all that.
Who were the coaches?
So no, I will not be playing because my neck is completely gone and I can't take any risks with it, but I will help as much as I can coaching-wise.
Who are the coaches currently at Oxford?
Wadey.
Still Wadey, yeah?
Yeah.
Excellent.
So Wadey and
I think Barry McGuigan was doing a little bit.
Exactly. Exactly. He's going back and forth. I think he's just because he's recovering from an injury at the moment. So
yeah.
I don't know exactly what his commitment is, but it's basically them two. Yeah.
Awesome. Right. Well, tell us about your podcast and social media and everything else, because I feel it's very important. And I feel that a lot of people are going to want to listen.
Well, that's very kind of you. So it's called Le French Podcast, because we didn't want to create anything very extraordinary, very, very original. It's basically just what we said earlier. Listen, all the questions that I get asked about, but why in France this, why that? So it's myself, Johnny BT, the former Scottish international who's been living in France for the last 10 years, and Tim Groves. And we are on social media, Instagram and Twitter and all those things. We try to either chat between the three of us about hot topics and get some very interesting guests. So we had Thierry du Sautoir, we had Stephen Armitage, we had Joe Rocothoco, we had Chris Massoi, we had Philippe Sella. Because you have to admit, the guests that you can get that either played or still play in top 14, their list is
huge,
mind-blowing. Just the last 10 years of the Toulon squad, you'll get about 10,000 caps in there. So, you know, if you could get the Johnny Wilkinson, Bakis Botta, Matt Guito, Mathieu Bastaro.
Matt Guito is a fantastic guest.
Some exposures on those guys, trying to get a maximum amount of French guys who can speak English to give their experience. What's the myth, the reality, the funny stories, and the differences and the particularity of French rugby? That's what we try to have a laugh with.
Wonderful. Well, thank you once more. Really, really enjoyed it. And let's catch up again soon.
Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.